Imagine waking up at like 2:30 in the morning, and not because of insomnia, and definitely not because you've got some early flight to catch.
Right.
You're just wide awake in the pitch black because, well, you recently survived a massive Widowmaker heart attack.
Wow. Yeah, that changes things.
It really does. And suddenly, the sheer fragility of your time on Earth is literally the only thing on your mind. I mean, that kind of brush with mortality just strips away all the superficial noise, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It creates this immediate, just profound shift in perspective. You know, when that illusion that we have unlimited time is finally shattered, the brain automatically starts hunting for what is actually essential.
Yeah, and that search for the essential is exactly what we are exploring today. So, welcome to the deep dive. We are looking at this incredible text today called Sunday Table, 52 Weekly Devotions.
It's a great one.
It really is. It's a book by Bishop Tim Lam. He's a veteran pastor and a denominational leader. And after that severe heart attack we just mentioned, Lam started sitting at his breakfast table in those super early hours of the morning, just writing down his reflections.
Right. He was essentially forging like a spiritual and mental tool belt, you know, trying to figure out how to navigate whatever rest of his life he had left.
Exactly. Which is an incredibly practical pursuit when you think about it.
Oh, for sure. He's taking these really high-level theological concepts and figuring out how they actually function on, you know, a random Tuesday morning when you're just totally overwhelmed.
Yeah, so our mission today is to extract those potent nuggets of wisdom. We're looking at his thoughts on leadership, on resilience, and daily habits. We are going to impartially look at the biblical framework Lam uses just to see what universal life lessons you, the listener, can apply to your own journey.
Regardless of your personal background, yeah.
Right. We're looking for those heavy-duty emergency tools, the ones that can save you when life just violently interrupts your plans.
And honestly, this is vital for you right now because we are all living in a moment of extreme collective burnout. I mean, we are bombarded by information, paralyzed by anxiety, constantly drifting.
Totally.
And Lamb's reflections offer a very clear blueprint for finding an anchor in the middle of all that modern chaos.
And building that anchor, it has to start with how you construct your 24 hours, because if you don't structure your day intentionally, you're just going to get swept away by the current.
Oh, absolutely.
Lam places a massive emphasis on this concept he calls bookends, basically how we start and end our days. Like we mentioned, his morning bookend starts at 2:30 a.m. to write.
Which, to be fair, he totally admits is not for everyone.
No, definitely not for me.
Right. Even his wife prefers the evening, but the specific hour isn't really the point, you
Right.
know, the intentionality is.
Yeah, the intentionality is what protects the machinery in our heads. And Lam grounds this need for daily structure in some pretty staggering human biology. Like, think about this. Our brains have 86 billion neurons firing electrical impulses at 268 miles per hour.
It's basically a supercomputer.
You are walking around with a supercomputer inside your skull. And yet, despite all this raw, staggering power, we still suffer from the most basic memory lapses.
Oh, the Tuesday story.
Yes. Lam tells this genuinely funny story about calling his friend on a Tuesday, like completely ready for their rigidly scheduled Wednesday prayer time.
And his friend is just too polite to immediately point out that Lamb is a full 24 hours early.
Right. He just goes along with it. It's funny, but it highlights the serious vulnerability in our hardware. That massive brain power gets drained incredibly fast by decision fatigue. I mean, Lam points out that the average adult makes like 35,000 decisions a day.
35,000. That is wild.
It is. So to combat this, Lam shares his personal strategy. He literally pre-plans his restaurant orders before he even leaves his house.
That's brilliant, actually.
Yeah, he just refuses to waste cognitive energy deciding between, you know, a chicken sandwich and a salad.
And that's not just some quirky habit. It's a really profound self-preservation tactic.
Right. And he connects this overwhelming volume of daily choices to the biblical story of Lot's wife. If you're unfamiliar, she's the figure who turned into a pillar of salt because she just couldn't stop looking backward at the destruction of her past while she was trying to flee.
Right.
But okay, let's unpack this a little bit. Because with 35,000 decisions a day, decision fatigue isn't just possible, it's inevitable.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to fail.
We are going to mess up some of those choices. So if our brains are that fast and powerful, why are we neurologically and emotionally so prone to looking back with regret? Are we literally hardwired to get stuck like Lot's wife, just analyzing our mistakes until we paralyze ourselves?
What's fascinating here is it comes down to the actual mechanism of regret. The human brain is basically a prediction machine. It uses past experiences to predict future outcomes so it can keep you safe.
Okay.
It's a survival trait, right? But when you are bombarded by 35,000 choices, your prefrontal cortex, the part responsible for logical decision-making, it just becomes completely...
burned out.
Exactly. And when that happens, your brain defaults to the amygdala, which is driven by fear and caution.
Yeah.
Suddenly, you become super risk-averse.
Yeah.
You start obsessively looking backward, caught in this feedback loop of analyzing every single error, every what-if.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you literally turn into a monument of your own mistakes. You're paralyzed by your own history.
So, how do we stop that neurological loop?
Well, Lam isn't asking us to be perfect decision makers.
Mm-hmm.
He knows we will fail.
Yeah.
Instead, he advises using hope as a mental and spiritual anchor. And he uses this great analogy from his own life. When he goes fishing on Lake Sinclair, he doesn't just drift out into the middle of the water and hope for the best.
Right.
The very first thing he does is throw a heavy anchor overboard.
I see. So he doesn't like drift away from where the fish actually are.
Precisely. Because the currents and winds are going to push the boat, whether he likes it or not. And those 35,000 daily winds of choice are going to push your mind. If you don't anchor your mind to a firm hope at the start of the day, that morning bookend we talked about, you will drift. You'll drift into anxiety, into regret, and into that paralysis of looking backward.
So the hope acts as like a cognitive shortcut.
Exactly, a heuristic. You no longer have to evaluate every single one of those 35,000 choices from scratch. You just ask, does this choice align with my anchor?
That makes a lot of sense. Dropping that anchor daily is what keeps you in place. But, you know, anchoring yourself against daily decisions requires knowing why you are making them in the first place.
Right.
Which brings us to this major distinction Lam makes regarding the macro trajectory of our lives. It's a difference between our assignments and our purpose.
And the way he discovers this difference is completely unprompted.
It really is. He's literally lying in a heart specialist's waiting room.
Yeah.
Dealing with these incredibly serious health issues. And a total stranger, a man who doesn't even know Lam is a minister, just looks at him and simply says, God isn't through with you yet.
Wow. That kind of unsolicited insight, it can be jarring, but it pierces right through the fear. And provides deep clarity.
It crystallized everything for him. He realized that assignments are short-term, highly variable tasks. They change constantly. One year, your assignment is this job. The next year, it's caring for a sick parent.
Yeah.
But purpose is a lifelong, consistent mission. And Lam is very clear that the path to discovering that purpose is rarely paved with comfort. He illustrates this with a story from 1989.
Oh, the Haiti story?
Yeah. He's in Haiti, walking down a dark dirt road at midnight. He's surrounded by rice paddies, hearing voodoo chants echoing in the distance, and he admits he is just absolutely terrified.
I mean, it is the ultimate picture of an uncomfortable, unfamiliar assignment.
Totally. But the discomfort goes way deeper than just a scary geographical location. It's often internal. Lam shares a very vulnerable story about his childhood struggle with a severe speech impediment.
Yeah, part was moving.
He remembers being a 14-year-old kid sitting in the back pew of his church, feeling totally broken. And he struck a bargain with God, praying that if his speech could somehow be healed, he would tell the whole world.
And then fast forward a few decades, and he's leveraging the internet to do exactly that.
Right, reaching a massive global audience. But here's where it gets really interesting. I have to look at the implication of this. It sounds like Lam is suggesting our deepest insecurities, the things we want to lock away and hide in the basement, like a stutter or a profound failure, aren't just obstacles to overcome.
No.
Saying those insecurities are the actual construction materials for our life's platform. Is that really how purpose is built? By like standing on our own brokenness?
That is exactly the synthesis Lam is pointing toward. See, we tend to view our lives in fragmented, isolated events.
Mm.
We think, here is my terrifying walk in Haiti. Here is my childhood stutter. Here is my heart attack.
But they're just random bad things.
All right, they feel like meaningless detours.
Yeah.
But Lam argues that if we faithfully navigate these confusing short-term assignments, they eventually synthesize into a visible, impactful purpose. The struggle isn't a detour from your purpose. The struggle is the raw material for your purpose.
That's a huge shift in perspective.
It is. Your insecurities and your survival stories are what actually give you the empathy and the authentic authority to help someone else. I mean, you can't lead people through the dark if you haven't been terrified in the dark yourself.
So we build the platform out of our struggles. But to execute that purpose day in and day out, We need resources, we need tangible provision, and we need the right words to connect with people.
Very true.
Let's look at how Lamb views tangible provision first. He shares this incredible memory of his grandfather, a man who was under 5 feet tall, who would cook these absolutely massive spreads of food for their large extended family.
Such a great visual.
And after everyone ate their fill, they'd drape a large tablecloth over the remaining food to protect it from the flies, just knowing there was plenty more to eat later.
It really paints such a vivid picture of a family gathering.
It does. And he connects this childhood memory of the tablecloth to the biblical accounts of provision, like the manna in the Exodus that sustained a whole nation, and the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000.
Right.
Lamb specifically zeroes in on a tiny detail in that story. After the massive crowd had eaten, there were 12 baskets of leftovers. The point he's driving home is that true provision isn't about barely scraping by. It's about enough and then some. The leftovers are literal proof of abundance.
And that abundance mindset changes how you operate entirely. When you really believe in enough and then some, you stop hoarding your resources and your energy out of fear. You become willing to give it away.
And the most important resource we give away isn't food, is it? It's our words.
Absolutely.
Words are the ultimate currency of connection. Lamb humorously calls them passwords. He brings up that old Flintstones cartoon where the Loyal Order of Water Buffaloes had a secret password to get into the lodge.
Oh, yeah. Akadak.
Yes. Akadak. He uses that to explain that, just like passwords grant us access in the digital world, specific phrases act as spiritual passwords that unlock human hearts. A simple phrase like, "How can I pray for you?" instantly grants you access to someone's inner life.
Which is an incredible privilege to be granted, really.
It is. But he warns that the words we use have to have real substance. He ties this to his wife, Carissa, who makes homemade jams, jellies, and preserves.
I loved this analogy.
So good. He points out there is a massive difference between them. Jelly is thin. It's basically just juice and sugar. But preserves have thick, real chunks of actual fruit in them.
Right.
Lamb notes that the biblical fruit of the Spirit, character traits like love, joy, peace, patience, they aren't meant to be thin and watery like jelly. They are meant to be thick with substance like preserves. You can't offer someone true, lasting gentleness if you don't also have the thick substance of self-control backing it up.
Because if it's thin, it breaks down the exact moment it's tested by stress.
Exactly. So think about this in your own life. If words are literally passwords that grant access, what happens when we use the wrong ones? Are we constantly accidentally hacking each other's emotional mainframes with careless comments?
Oh, wow.
Because if we accidentally hurt someone, we can't just use thin, watery apologies to get back in. We need the thick preserves of genuine patience. But how do we actively make that switch? How do we switch from spreading junk code to offering those healing passwords?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it requires an intense level of intentionality because words carry actual biological and emotional weight.
They really do.
When you speak to someone, you are either triggering a spike in their cortisol, which is the stress hormone that causes lasting physiological wear and tear, or you are releasing dopamine and oxytocin, which literally invigorates their nervous system.
That's wild to think about.
Right. When you throw out a careless word, you are doing measurable damage. So to switch to offering those thick preserves, you have to pause before you speak and become a gatekeeper of your own speech. You have to ask yourself, is this word granting access to healing, or is it breaking down their defenses just to cause pain?
But being that intention, I mean, acting as a constant gatekeeper for your words and decisions, that takes an immense amount of energy. And no matter how well we steward that energy, life is eventually going to violently interrupt our plans.
Oh, inevitably.
So the tool belt needs to have something for those catastrophic moments.
The heavy-duty tools we reserve for the uninvited intruders of life.
Yes. Lamb shares a story that is just pure adrenaline. It's 3 a.m. The wind blows his front door open, which trips the home security alarm.
Terrifying already.
Right. He wakes up completely disoriented, walks out of his bedroom, and finds three sheriff's deputies standing in his hallway, pointing 9mm pistols right at him.
Oh, my God.
He literally screams, "Don't shoot me."
That is a visceral, terrifying shock to the system.
It's insane. And he compares that sudden, violent invasion of his safety to the biblical figure Job, whose life was demolished by tragedy without any warning.
Right.
But, you know, not all intruders kick the door down at 3 a.m. Some of them are slow and grinding and quiet, like sickness.
Yeah, that's true.
Lamb recounts sitting by his sister Teresa's wheelchair as she battled cancer. He talks about the agonizing reality of being stuck in the waiting rooms of life. You're sitting there entirely powerless, watching someone you love suffer, and there is absolutely nothing you can do to speed up the clock.
It's so hard.
He leans on the imagery from the book of Isaiah about finding the strength to soar like eagles when you are completely depleted.
Because in those waiting rooms, your own strength is gone.
Yeah.
You cannot manufacture resilience out of thin air when you are that deeply exhausted.
So how do you survive that without completely breaking? If we are guaranteed to face the 9mm pistols in the cancer waiting rooms, how do we prepare?
Well, Lamb says the answer is the Sabbath.
Intentional rest. He tells the story of an author named Lance Witt who, when he was first learning to ride a bike, didn't know how to use the brakes.
No.
The only way he knew how to stop was by physically crashing his bike into a parked car.
That's hilarious but painful.
Right. And Lamb is incredibly honest here. He admits his own failures with this. As a young pastor, he once scheduled a barbecue fundraiser, a church revival, and the paving of the church parking lot all on the exact same day.
Oh my goodness.
Which was supposed to be his time off.
He was riding the bike at top speed and refusing to use the brakes.
Well, we all do this. It's like we treat rest as a luxury, or worse, we treat it as a sign of weakness or a lack of ambition.
Mm-hmm.
But Lamb delivers a massive reality check to you listening right now. If you don't intentionally schedule your Sabbath, your body and your mind will eventually schedule it for you by crashing into a wall.
The physiology behind this is just fascinating. It's about allostatic, the cumulative wear and tear on your body from chronic stress. When the uninvited intruders of life show up, whether it's an acute shock like the break-in or a chronic grief like the waiting room, your ability to respond without shattering is entirely dependent on your baseline.
Right, where you're starting from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you run your life at maximum cortisol every single day, the moment a real crisis hits, your system fails. You have to learn to stop without crashing during your normal quiet days.
Wow.
If you don't practice the Sabbath when the sea is calm, you just won't have the neurological or spiritual resilience to survive when the hurricane hits. Rest isn't a vacation. It is the armor you forge for the unpredictable battles of life.
And forging that armor brings us to the final overarching theme of the text, which is legacy. Because our time is limited and because we know it will be interrupted by these uninvited intruders, the influence we allow into our lives and the influence we leave behind becomes the most important thing we do. Lamb talks deeply about mentorship. He fondly remembers his dad, who didn't just lecture him on abstract concepts. His dad taught him how to fish, to play basketball, and how to safely hammer a nail.
Right. Hands-on stuff.
Through those physical shared actions, his dad was transferring core values. And the text drops a statistic that should honestly stop us in our tracks. 76% of people think mentors are important, but only 37% actually have one.
That is a massive mentorship deficit.
Yeah.
We all recognize the profound need for guidance, but very few of us are willing to cross the bridge to initiate that relationship.
But the truth is, whether we formally sign up for it or not, we are always mentoring someone. People are always watching.
Definitely.
Lamb illustrates this with the Preacher Seuss story. He's at a Cracker Barrel, and a 4-year-old boy walks up to his table and asks, "Are you a preacher?"
I love this story.
Lamb smiles, says yes, and asks the boy how he knew. The kid points down and says, "Because you are wearing preacher's shoes. My preacher wears shoes like that."
That's so funny.
It's a lighthearted, funny moment, but the underlying truth is profound. The next generation notices absolutely everything.
They are constantly absorbing our modeled behavior, right down to the shoes we wear.
But you know, the story that hits the hardest regarding our legacy is in the discussion on brevity. Lamb shares the story of a man who decided to visualize his actual lifespan.
This is intense.
It is. He calculated 70 years worth of weeks and put that exact number of marbles into a large glass jar. And every single week, without fail, he would physically reach in and remove one marble, throwing it away, just to visually represent the brevity of his life.
That is a stark, almost brutal visual of our own mortality.
It really is. Visualizing your life as a physical jar of marbles slowly emptying out, I mean, that is intense. So what does this all mean for you, the listener, I have to ask? Does an exercise like that induce existential panic, you know, staring at the reality of your shrinking time? Or does it actually free you to cut out the noise and focus strictly on what matters?
This raises an important question. And Lamb's perspective is that acknowledging our expiration date shouldn't induce dread. Instead, it creates a holy urgency.
Holy urgency. I like that.
Yeah. When you see those marbles disappearing, you stop pretending you have unlimited time to fix broken relationships. You stop waiting for the perfect moment to chase your actual purpose.
Right.
It forces you to actively choose who you mentor and who you allow to mentor you. The shrinking jar of marbles is the ultimate focusing tool. It gives you the permission to stop wasting your energy on the petty arguments, the loose ends, and all the daily distractions.
It's the ultimate filter for those 35,000 decisions we have to make every day. So let's bring this entire tool belt together. We've journeyed from waking up in the early hours, learning to drop an anchor of hope so our fatigued brains don't leave us frozen like Lot's wife.
Right.
We've seen how our deepest insecurities and painful assignments are actually the bricks used to build our life's purpose. We've learned to embrace the abundance of the leftovers and to use the thick preserves of our words to heal rather than harm.
Beautifully said.
We've seen the absolute physiological necessity of scheduling rest so we don't crash when the intruders come. And finally, we've looked at the marble jar of our legacy.
It is a profoundly cohesive framework for living deeply, intentionally, and without regret.
But if you are listening to this right now and feeling completely overwhelmed, like if you feel like your marble jar is getting dangerously low, or you spent your life crashing your bike into parked cars, or you've used the wrong passwords with the people you love, Lam offers one final piece of grace.
Thank goodness.
Right. He shares this hilarious memory from a 1980s computer class. He was totally out of his depth, just staring blankly at the screen. The instructor, who had a very thick accent, looked at the confused class and yelled, "E-boot your computer."
Reboot your computer.
Reboot your computer. Lam uses that funny memory to remind us of a vital truth. No matter how badly the system has crashed, a spiritual reboot is always available. You can always hit restart.
The operating system of your life can always be cleared of the errors, and you can begin again today.
Which brings us right back to that spiritual tool belt we started with. You have the tools now. So think about your own jar of marbles sitting on the counter. If you were to take one marble out of your jar today, what is the one password you need to speak to someone or the one reboot you need to give yourself before that marble is gone forever? It's your platform. What are you going to build with it today?